morning, Mr. Wright.
May it please the court, I'm Christopher Wright, representing Iran. We agree completely with the United States on the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act issue, namely that McKesson does not have a cause of action under that act. I therefore, because in order to prevail, will need to prevail on some other issues, intend to focus on those other issues. Let me add that I also intend to use my limited time to focus on arguments where we do not disagree with the United States. As you know, the United States has not taken a position on the Iranian law issues and has declined to address some other issues. So I wanted to make that point at the start. The Treaty of Amity authorizes American companies to sue in Iran and then seek relief from the International Court of Justice. I'd like to make 6 points designed to show that that was intended to be the exclusive remedy, certainly under Iranian law. And remember, the last time this case was before this court, you determined that McKesson does not have a cause of action under the treaty, and the district court has decided that it does have an action under the treaty under Iranian law. So the 6 points mostly have to do with the drafting history of the act. Let me acknowledge at the outset that the treaty sets forth a remedy and a forum and does not say that it's exclusive. But I think when you look at the drafting history, you'll become convinced that it was intended to be that. First, as the Supreme Court said in Sabatino, in the mid-50s, the practice was, in an expropriation case, that you went to the courts of the country alleged to have committed the expropriation, and if dissatisfied, asked your government to help you go to an international tribunal. That is exactly what the Treaty of Amity provides.
When you say exclusive, you mean exclusive of a remedy in the United States?
Yes, Your Honor, that the forum.
Well, what's your reaction? I mean, the State Department says that this is a very typical treaty, and that, yeah, it creates a remedy for American companies in Iran, but it says nothing about the traditional remedy that American companies can seek against foreign sovereigns in our country, and it says that if we accept your interpretation, we're going to be changing how dozens and dozens of treaties like this work. And he actually says it could, State Department says, could interfere significantly with American foreign policy.
Well, Your Honor, that's part of the reason I'm wanted to make 6 points about the unique draft.
And we owe some deference to the State Department on that, don't we?
Yes, yeah. Although if this court's decision is based on the unique drafting history of this treaty, there's no reason why it should affect any other treaties. And I'd note that the Justice Department did not even address the drafting history in its brief. McKesson has devoted 2 sentences to it, and the district court didn't address it either. So if this court's decision is based on the drafting history, that responds to the State Department's concern about other treaties, in our view. So we also pointed out that at the time this treaty was adopted, there is no case where a party had successfully sued for expropriation in a U.S. court. No one has brought such a case to our attention. In addition, and perhaps more tellingly, Iran resisted the attempt to allow the International Court of Justice to apply the treaty. It ultimately receded and allowed in the treaty for the parties to go and get application of the treaty in the International Court of Justice.
What's the significance of that to your point?
If Iran,
the exclusive remedy.
If Iran had intended, if it certainly didn't intend there to be court cases in the United States, if it was resisting a neutral forum.
When did this resistance occur that you're talking about?
Well, the treaty was negotiated between 1954 and 1957. In our brief, we review this history.
When you say they resisted it, I'm not The treaty, as it comes out, has that language in there. And how are we supposed to know they resisted it, and what does it mean? So what if they resisted it?
Well, if Iran, one of the two parties to the agreement between the two governments, had doubts about whether it wanted to agree to the use of a neutral forum, it would be very surprising. They certainly weren't intending to
waive. Is it not evident, though, that they laid such doubts to rest, and I'm not sure why there is relevance of such doubts to the interpretation of the treaty?
Well, let me try my fourth point. My fourth point is that the State Department cited the fact that the treaty ultimately permits the use of a neutral forum in support of its in saying that this provides valuable assurances to U.S. investors. Now, surely, if anyone thought that suits could be brought in the United States, that would provide even more valuable assurances to U.S.
investors.
Well,
maybe it's for cases where they can't get jurisdiction over the foreign sovereign for some reason, or where there's immunity in the U.S. courts.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but I think that if you have jurisdiction here, I'm not sure what those cases would be. But I don't think
you had no direct effect in the United States. Right. If you had an expropriation and could not show a direct effect, or you couldn't get a panel to hold that that's enough of a direct effect.
Yeah, of course, if a company in the United States has its property expropriated, I would think that they would get over
it. You're
that.
Talking about 1957. There really was no authority at that time that that was a direct effect for FSIA purposes, was there, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
In fact, it was quite a few years later before that would have been held direct, wouldn't it?
So, I'm sorry?
Really quite a few years after that before there was a holding that
right.
The fact that an American company lost money would be considered a direct effect in the United States.
I suppose that wasn't certain then, but let me say that sort of...
I think it was very arguable, wasn't it? I mean, I'm not trying to push you over the wall, but I think... The idea that that's enough for direct effect came in much later than that.
Well, let me try it this way, Your Honor. This would have been groundbreaking for the parties to agree that suit could be brought in the United States. And yet no one said anything to that effect.
At the time this was negotiated, when was the FSIA passed? When was it enacted?
It was later.
Later. So at this time, it was very clear under the U.S. Code that U.S. companies could bring diversity actions in U.S. courts against foreign sovereigns, correct?
I'm sorry, could bring diversity actions?
Diversity actions against in U.S. courts against foreign sovereigns. That's what the diversity statute says, right?
We found no case where anyone successfully did that in an expropriation case, Your Honor.
I'm not sure what would... But there's nothing in the statute that says they can bring diversity actions except in expropriation cases. I mean, the legal background here is that was the legal background at the time the FSIA was enacted. And so it seems to me you need to find, for you to prevail, you need to find something in the treaty that not just creates a forum for a United States company in Iran, but eliminates the forum that existed then in the U.S. courts.
Well, again, Your Honor, if that forum existed, we found no case where, and no one has pointed out one where it was used. And as the Supreme Court said in Sabatino, that wasn't the practice at the time. The practice at the time was you went to the foreign country and then you went to an international tribunal. This would be a dead letter, essentially, because companies like McKesson would go to courts in the U.S. They wouldn't go to Iran in the neutral forum.
But if the government's right that this is a fairly typical treaty, that this language is typical in of many, many treaties, it might well be that in other countries that have treaties like this, American companies who have confidence in the foreign courts might be comfortable suing in the foreign courts. Whereas in a case like Iran, they might not be.
Right. Well, again, Your Honor, though, I do want to point out that The United States certainly hasn't told us that the drafting history of these other treaties is similar to this drafting history, and that seems to us to make all the difference here.
Are you now abandoning your argument that it's Article 3, Clause 2 of the treaty that provides access here, so you're focusing not on that now, but on this drafting history?
I'm not abandoning anything, Your Honor, and you know, as you know, this is a massive case, and with 10 minutes, I have limited things to talk about. Let me use my final point to say a word about the application of Iranian law here. I think a fair reading of the district court's decision is that it didn't really grapple with Iranian law. It took the prior decisions decided under American law and simply said, oh, Iranian law is similar. I think that's most evident with respect to the interest award, which is more than 80% of the judgment here. And the district court actually awarded interest purportedly under Iranian law using the U.S. prime rate. That's not a plausible reading of Iranian law.
Our review of the district court's interpretation of Iranian law, is this de novo?
Or yes, Your Honor.
Do we owe any deference to the district court?
I don't believe so in your interpretation of Iranian law, Your Honor.
It differs somewhat from a question of law to, say, a question of foreign law, but I suppose the review standard might still be the same.
Whatever the standard is, it is not appropriate to use the U.S. prime rate under Iranian law to impose interest, which, of course, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, interest is not permitted in
anyway.
Any way.
Yeah.
One of the arguments, since you're talking about the Iranian legal issues, one of the arguments that McKesson makes in its brief focuses on these three statutes, the Civil Code, the Commercial Code, and the Civil Responsibility Act. And they argue in their brief that while you make arguments about the first two, you don't say anything at all about the Civil Responsibility Act, and that they can get all the relief they need under that.
Okay, Your Honor, our primary argument with respect to those other provisions is that there is a cause of action under Iranian law under the Treaty of Amity, but that is the exclusive remedy
well, but suppose you're
under
wrong
Iranian
about that.
Law.
Suppose you're wrong about that. If that argument fails, don't they have a point then that your failure to make an argument under the Civil Responsibility Act leaves that open to them as a complete remedy, assuming they win on the other issues, like attribution and things like that, which I realize you argue need to be re-looked at under Iranian law, right?
If we're wrong on preemption and we're wrong on attribution, we may well be wrong there, except the interest award would still be gross.
I understood. That's a fair point. But you accept their point that if you're wrong on attribution and if you're wrong on exclusivity, that the way this case has been briefed, that the Civil Responsibility Act does provide a remedy, subject, of course, to your point about interest. Right?
One important defense also runs through all of these.
Yeah.
In the Iranian law treaty cause of action, Iran's primary defense will be that it didn't pay the dividends to McKesson on account of currency control laws. As the district court said at one point, Iran, which is in the middle of the Iran-Iraq war, wants to prevent capital flight. If that is the reason that Pak Dairy didn't pay the dividends because Iranian law prevented it, we believe that's a defense under
right, that's your
any cause
say, but,
of action.
But their response to that is that the currency controls did prevent Pak Dairy from paying up until, was it September 8th? What year am I talking about?
September of 1981.
This case has been along for so long. Until September 81, but that after that point, Pak could have paid in local currency and didn't.
And Pak and Iran say that they would have if McKesson had asked for it, had come to the country and asked for it, or gone to Geneva and negotiated with Iran. It chose instead to go to the Iranian Claims Tribunal rather than and it's our understanding that under Iranian law, McKesson still owns 31% of PAC Dairy, and it's still getting dividends credited to its account. We don't think that McKesson has a remedy against the sovereign.
I mean, so all it needs to do today is just ask, and it'll get all the dividends?
They won't get $43 million, including 30-some-odd million.
Forget the compound interest thing, but you mean if they just go over there now and ask, they go to the company and ask, they'll get all the money? Why are they spending all this time? Why are we at McKesson 5, 6, excuse me, if that's the case?
5 or 6 or whatever it is.
Yeah, I believe this is 6.
Right, this is 6. So why are we here if they could have just gone 20 years ago and asked for the money and gotten it?
The district court's answer on this is in its...
No, I'm asking what your answer is.
Well, my answer is that they could, and they haven't.
No, they could solve this whole thing could be over today if they just asked for it?
They would get less money if they did that than if the district court's judgment is affirmed. They'd probably get considerably less money.
But why wouldn't they take what they've got and continue their lawsuit? I mean,
I'll ask them when they stand up. A double remedy.
We'll ask them when they stand up. Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Now, you did use your time up. We will give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed. We'll hear from the appellee and then the amicus. We've been asked for and have agreed to a extraordinary procedure where we're letting you have a minute to rebut the amicus. I don't want that to be taken as precedent. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mark Bravin, counsel for McKesson, the appellee. Let me begin by reviewing exactly what Iran did to prevent McKesson from getting its money from PAC Dairy.
Could you just get the money now by asking?
No. No, in fact, the McKesson 3 court remanded for a trial to address the question of whether the reason McKesson didn't get paid was because there was some come-to-the-company rule, as Iran contended. And the trial found no evidence for such a rule.
Have you made a demand or request in country for the money?
Many times. And, in fact, there was dramatic trial.
When was the last time?
The last time was in 1980, when McKesson's
The last 31 years, have you renewed a request that you be paid your dividends?
The request in person at PAC Dairy was made last in 1980.
When have you made such a request in 31 years then?
In litigation.
If not, why not?
When they didn't pay, the United States transferred our lawsuit, which was commenced in 1981, in 1980, and we went off to litigate. And throughout all this litigation,
well, you can't walk and chew gum at the same time, though. And I see that you're walking. I'm trying to find out why you're not also chewing gum. If and it seems to have been a position taken for some little while that they would pay you the dividends if you asked for them, why hasn't somebody gone over there and asked for them?
That's not a correct statement by counsel for Iran as to the position. The position was a vote of the board of directors controlled by Iran that PAC Dairy would pay no money to McKesson for any reason, and the Iran Claims Tribunal held that decision was never rescinded. The district court held the decision was never rescinded. And so going back over these years would have been a futile act. And in fact, the district court held a trial at the request of McKesson 3, and in the trial held, McKesson would not have been paid the dividends had it gone back. And when it asked someone to declare the dividends paid, he was arrested and interrogated for helping the American devil. So it was a futile act to ask for the dividends at any point over the last 30 years. For reasons that Mr. Byron, I'm sure, will address, the United States agrees that the act of state doctrine doesn't apply because this case involves the bad acts of a majority shareholder who controlled the board of directors of a company to squeeze out the minority shareholder. As the court below made clear in the 2010 opinion, Iran's currency controls have absolutely nothing to do with this case. They were never put in issue. 10 years ago, Iran's counsel told the court that the reason McKesson didn't receive its dividends was this rule of come to the company. They got a trial. They couldn't prove it. Their accountant on the stand said, the reason we didn't pay was McKesson didn't come to the company. On cross-examination, he broke down and admitted that come to the company was not at any point a rule at Pac Dairy. Iran's other witness that testified on this subject, Dr. Sanai, who was with the central bank, again, did not say that currency controls ever prevented Pac Dairy from paying these dividends, not before September 1981, not after September 1981. The decision was made not to pay McKesson for any reason, not in reals. They asked for reals, the local currency. They were not paid. That has nothing to do with currency controls. That has to do with an anti-American decision made by Iran in the corporate boardroom to discriminate against the only American shareholder, McKesson. Now, the simple approach to this case at this point is for the court to decide under the Civil Responsibility Act, as Judge Tatel referred before, that Iran is liable because McKesson has shown the three elements: injury, fault, and causation.
Can we decide that now, or we have some earlier issues we have to resolve, don't we, before you get there? Like, for example, what kind of cause of action exists in this country, in the district court, right? We have to do that first.
Yes, and it's well established under Rule 44.1 that our federal courts may apply foreign law causes of action to afford relief to an American plaintiff against a foreign party.
Okay, now that's not a treaty claim. That's just a straight FSIA claim in U.S. federal court,
that's
right?
That's correct. And we have four of those.
Yes, I understand that. Okay, so we get over that hump, and then we're looking at questions of Iranian law.
Correct, and there's nothing in that Iranian statute that poses any problems for the court.
Question, what about the attribution issue?
There are two answers to attribution.
Let me ask you the question before
me
the answer. Okay. Counsel for Iran said, the problem with the district court's resolution of that issue is that he was looking at it as a U.S. treaty issue, namely one decided by American or international law, whereas, as you just said, the cause of action isn't a treaty action, it's a basically diversity action, right? So doesn't he need to look at that issue under Iranian law?
The district judge had two routes to reach the decision, and this court can affirm under either.
Uh-huh.
First is the guidance from the Supreme Court in Banco Nacional de Cuba, the bank check case, where our Supreme Court said, we do not apply the law of the foreign state in deciding whether the state may be held responsible for acts of its agencies and instrumentalities taken abroad. We look to our principles. The court laid out the criteria. This court
was an FSIA action?
Yes, it was.
Under foreign law?
No, it was not under foreign law.
What was it under? It was under U.S. law, right?
The dispute arose with respect to Cuba. And what the Supreme Court said was, when a foreign sovereign is before our courts under our law, we apply our principles of attribution to decide whether the foreign sovereign will be held accountable. We're not going to let some foreign sovereign who may have written into its laws that it's never held accountable come before our courts and disclaim liability or jurisdiction based on their foreign law.
Uh-huh.
But that's not the only answer.
Okay.
That's not quite what they're doing in the part of this case that Judge Tatel is exploring. They're not saying they're never liable. They're saying that on the facts of this case, there can't be attribution, that only the actor is liable. And it would seem, if I read correctly the analysis of Iranian law, that would not even necessarily require them to be sovereign to make that defense. They're simply saying Iranian law doesn't provide for this kind of attribution.
Firstly, the attribution idea that Iran has raised is a complete misdirection. When the case arrived at the federal court after the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal had decided in the arbitration award in 1986, The federal court was obliged under the Algiers Accords to take the findings and conclusions of the tribunal as binding. And one of those findings and conclusions, which the district court applied, was that Iran was directly responsible, not indirectly through attribution, but that Iran caused the harm in the Pakdari boardroom. And that finding was the beginning of the motion for summary judgment that Judge Flannery ruled on in 1997. But there's a separate and important answer here. Uh-huh. In the record, you will find that under Iranian law, when one party so dominates others as to force them to do wrong, that dominating party is directly responsible. It's not attribution, it's direct responsibility.
That's what the district court ruled, right?
District court did not expressly touch on this point of Iranian law, but McKesson's Iranian law expert, Mr. Khatirai, explained this principle. This court may affirm on that alternative ground that even under Iranian law, Iran is directly responsible, not attribution liability, not vicarious liability, but direct liability.
And what about the what can you point to in the record that supports the notion of compound interest in Iran?
Yeah.
The Iranian law expert, Mr. Khatirai, in two expert opinions described in great detail the treatment of interest under Iranian law. Firstly,
does he use the word compound interest?
The word compound interest is not even used in American law. It's a practice. There's not a statute that provides for compound interest. What our law says
tell me where in the record I find something that says under Iranian law you can get compound interest. What's your best source in the record?
The supplemental and second supplemental opinions of Mr. Khatirai explain.
Give us a JA page.
All right.
Whose expert is this, by the way?
This is McKesson.
Your expert. Okay.
This is JA page 709.
Uh-huh. And is this his point that Iranian law sort of accepts customary international principles?
No, that's an alternative argument that the Treaty of Amity provides a rule of decision under Iranian law, so that even if the court affirms under the Civil Responsibility Act, it may apply the full compensation remedy under the treaty.
Wait, what's the Treaty of Amity has to do? I don't understand what the treaty has to do with this anymore.
The treaty has a prompt, adequate, and effective compensation rule.
But that's if you sue under the treaty.
No, that's if the treaty provides a rule of decision. Whether or not you sue under the treaty, Iran has conceded in its briefs that the treaty provides a rule of decision.
For lawsuits in this country?
For lawsuits where they may be brought. Iran says the suit can only be brought in Iran, but that doesn't change what the treaty says. Even Iran says...
Well, I thought your point was, and the government's point was, the treaty just doesn't speak to lawsuits in this country, to domestic lawsuits.
The treaty provides a remedy of compensation, a prompt, adequate, and effective compensation. It does not require that the suit be brought in one form or another. In fact, many of the disputes under the treaty were resolved in arbitration. This suit is being resolved in this court.
What in the treaty establishes that you get this compound interest? I'm missing two or three steps here of some sort.
The steps are as follows. The compensation remedy is as of the date of expropriation. That's what the treaty means when it says prompt, adequate, and effective. The district court...
Read me the whole sentence. It says prompt, adequate, and effective.
The full sentence, I don't have the treaty text right in front of me, but that is the formula in the treaty, and it's not in dispute, and it was held by the district court, and it was held by the...
It's obviously in dispute as to whether it has caused this result or not.
What is in...
Those words are in the treaty. I am not at all convinced by the fact that the words prompt, adequate, and effective occur in the treaty that you get anything, let alone that you get compound interest.
The Iran Claims Tribunal made it very clear that the concept of prompt and adequate compensation means that if compensation is withheld for many years, interest will accrue.
Right. Tell me the words that they used to establish that.
The words of...
The words that the tribunal used to determine what you just said. Well, I'm trying to follow your steps to get from this treaty over to where you're entitled to compound interest. And
the compound interest entitlement does not come out of the words of the treaty or out of the words of the tribunal. Okay. The entitlement to compound interest comes in two ways. One, this court in McKesson 3 held that if the district court is applying a discretionary rule to determine how to compute interest, it is within the discretion of the district court to apply compound interest. Why? Because only compound interest will adequately and fully compensate an injured party.
Okay, but this isn't a rule. Is that a question? But he wasn't looking at Iranian law when he said that.
Right.
That's the question here.
When the judge in the latest decision reached compound interest, yeah, he was looking at Iranian law. And the opinion
that's
of
that's where we're having trouble, right, is getting Iranian law to supply the remedy, right, of compound interest.
Well, it can't be summarized in just a few words, but on the page I referred...
Do the best you can.
Well, as I referred...
You had a whole brief to do this in, and...
Well, as I said, on page 709 of our expert's opinion, Mr. Katirai explains that the Civil Procedure Code, as interpreted by an expert of Iranian law in Iran, a Dr. Shams, is that compound interest is allowable. Damages from damages...
The words compound interest appear in his testimony.
No. First of all, he writes in...
Right, they do not.
He writes in Farsi, Your Honor. This is a translation. The translation...
Well, it appears in the translation.
The translation is damages from damages must be considered as demandable. That's a direct quote from page 709.
Now that's where he differed from the other expert on Iranian law.
Right. The other expert did not cite to any authority. He just simply said, I don't think it's allowable. Mm-hmm. And that was one reason why the district court...
I thought he testified that damages on damages were not allowable.
That's right.
Right.
But he...
And your expert testified damages on damages were allowable.
And he cited authority to support him. And the district court looked at the two experts' opinions and agreed with McKesson's expert that it is allowable. And the rule is...
Under the commercial code, right?
Under the civil procedure code.
Civil procedure code, sorry. So now this has nothing to do with the treaty, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's out of the picture now, the
it's
treaty?
It's not out of the picture because the treaty is an alternative grounds to affirm the award of interest.
Okay,
it's
well,
full
you
compensation.
You still then have to help me with an antecedent problem, just try to help me understand this. I thought your position and the United States' position is that the Treaty of Amity creates a remedy in the Iranian courts for a U.S. company, right?
No, that's not quite right, Your Honor.
It's not?
No. Our position is that the Treaty of Amity provides a cause of action in any court that has jurisdiction, that nothing in the treaty says...
No, but suppose you're wrong about that. The Supreme Court's decision in Medellin suggests you're probably wrong about that. That the remedy you have here is a traditional FSI suit against a foreign sovereign. It has nothing to do with the treaty. The treaty under the Supreme Court's Medellin decision doesn't create any rights in this country, right?
We're before this court under Iranian law now and under international law. Medellin said nothing about when a foreign law cause of action is before the court.
Exactly. That's why it seems to me I can't get around is how you can talk about anything other than Iranian law in this case.
Well, that brings me back to my main point. The easiest way to resolve this case is under Iranian law and under the Civil Responsibility Act. And at that point, the treaty becomes irrelevant.
You just answered Chief Judge Sentell's question, and you conceded that affidavit says nothing about compound interest.
No, Your Honor. No. I pointed to the page where the affidavit specifically addresses compound interest.
And then you told me it didn't say anything about compound interest.
No, I said it doesn't use those words. This is a translation from Farsi, but the words are clear. It's damages from damages. And the briefs explain.
That comes a long way from saying compound interest is awarded.
Not according to the expert of Iranian law on which the court relied.
Not according to the expert of Iranian law who said nothing about compound interest. You just told me the expert said nothing about compound interest, I thought.
Iran's expert said, without citing any authority, it's not allowed.
Right.
McKesson's expert said a lot about
it. Now, McKesson's what is there that says it is allowed?
Right on the page that I referred you to, Your Honor, McKesson's expert explains, and he does through many pages.
Did your expert use the words compound interest or not?
Yes, he did.
He did? Yes. Okay. Well, why did you not tell me that the other times that I asked you if he used the words? Where did he use the words compound interest, and what did he say about it?
All right. I will refer to it in just a moment. All right, on the same page 709, last sentence of the paragraph before subsection D, and I quote, "Even before the enactment of the Iranian Civil Procedure Act of 2000, Iranian banks were authorized to collect compound interest, provided, however, that such interest had been provided for in the contract between the bank and its customer." Now, this is not a case about banks, and it's not a case about contracts.
It's not a case where anybody has agreed that they can do it.
No, there's no agreement.
Banks could collect it. Do you have anything about courts awarding compound interest on damages?
No, Your Honor, but we're talking about a civil law system. Courts, it's not like the common law system. You look to the statutes, not to the courts.
Do you have anything in the statutes of Iran that say courts can award compound?
Yes, and in fact, Mr. Katirai explained how the Civil Procedure Act governs the award of interest and made it very clear that it is no longer prohibited to award compound interest. And furthermore, because it's not prohibited, under federal common law, our court, this court, has the authority to affirm the award of compound interest to ensure the remedy of full compensation. It's a remedy in Iranian law, and it's a remedy under the treaty. Even
what
if you don't...
What we're trying to find is where it's a remedy in Iranian law. And I don't think we're being terribly obtuse to say that you haven't really given us a very direct answer to the question of where we would find the authority. As you concede, this is a civil law system. If they can do it, it should be in a statute somewhere or a rule. But we're having a hard time finding that you're telling us it's anywhere.
The rule under the Iranian statute is full compensation. If it is not prohibited, and it is not prohibited under Iranian law, the court has the authority to fashion the remedy. And in this case, the district court agreed with McKesson's expert that fashioning the remedy requires compound interest. It is what this court in McKesson 3 affirmed when it looked at Judge Flannery's decision on compound interest. It said the district court has the discretion.
He wasn't, Judge Flannery wasn't looking at Iranian law, was he?
No, he wasn't.
Well, that's why that has nothing to do with this.
It is relevant.
Why?
Because in applying the remedy, he is looking to federal common law to fill in a blank. Nothing in the treaty by word says compound interest. So federal common law gave the authority to fill in the blank.
No, no, no. If you're right that there is a cause of action in this country, in our courts, under the treaty, then you might well be right. But my questions are based on the assumption that you're wrong about that, and that all you have, not all, because it's not a minimal remedy, what you have here is a standard FSIA diversity action, basically. And in that case, you look to Iranian law, not U.S. law. And I'm not saying in my questions, I'm not saying to you that I think this record shows that compound interest isn't available. I just can't tell one way or the other. That's what I can't imagine how you would expect us to make a finding about this based on this record. That's what I just don't understand.
The finding,
one way or the other.
The finding is supported in the following way.
Firstly, yeah,
it is undisputed.
Give me your best shot.
It's undisputed that full compensation is the standard, is the remedy. So the question is, how does the court determine what is full compensation where the wrongful acts, the taking occurred 30 years ago?
But don't the Iranian experts, don't their affidavits in this case say there is no interest under Iranian law?
No, not at all.
They don't?
No. Mr. Katirai explains very clearly and simply that it is a mistaken notion that interest is not allowed.
Right.
In fact, Iran itself asked for interest.
Compound interest.
Compound interest, he also explains, is not prohibited. That's all.
That's a very different thing. Right. There's all kinds of things that are not expressly prohibited that are not within the authority of a court. Here, there, or anywhere in the world. And you keep coming back to that, well, it's not prohibited. I don't think there's anything that... There are lots of things we can't do that we're not expressly prohibited from doing. I'm not going to start giving examples, but you can think of them. Okay. But is there something that actually shows that the Iranian courts do award compound interest? If they do, then you ought to have something.
No, there is nothing that shows that the Iranian courts award compound
You've been in this case 30 years or thereabouts. Or you? No, you haven't, but lawyers have been in this case 30 years or thereabouts, right?
Correct.
And nobody has yet come up with an example of an Iranian court awarding compound interest, right?
Correct. And there's a reason for that, Your Honor.
I'm sure there is.
And the reason is, firstly, that Iranian law only came into this case in the last decision, the Kesson 5.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2008.
That was 3 years ago.
Correct. And so following...
They've been lawyers on this case for 3 years since Iranian law came,
and,
right?
And the district court had before it, and you have before you, several expert opinions that explain in detail that the principle that applies here is full compensation. And unless it's prohibited...
What applies is full compensation.
And unless...
Now, do you think for 1 minute that Iran and the United States are going to agree 100% on what the phrase full compensation means?
It's not necessary that they apply, that they agree fully.
Right. We only have to apply Iranian law. It doesn't matter what the United States thinks it means. We have to apply Iranian law, right?
Correct. And right. Iranian law includes...
You have no Iranian law that has ever awarded compound interest under that full compensation formula, right?
Well, Your Honor, you're viewing this through a common law court lens. In Iran,
I'm attempting to view it through Iranian law, and you're not giving me any Iranian law that says compound interest has ever been awarded to anybody, right? You're not giving me any authority under the codes of Iran that says that they can award it. You're taking that phrase full compensation and interpreting it to mean compound interest. We're asking you why. You're giving us nothing except telling us we're looking through the wrong lens.
Well, it's not that I'm giving you nothing, Your Honor. The court has before it the task of interpreting and applying Iranian law. It has before it the expert opinions. There's nothing in the expert opinions that will tell you that the district court got it wrong. So the question is, are you going to follow the same analysis? And I believe that when you look at the expert opinions...
Did one expert say he could award compound and the other say he couldn't?
Yes, and one was more credible and the other was less credible in the eyes of the district court. And the reason was...
Now, that brings me back to the question I asked a while ago. Is this a de novo examination?
Yes, it is. And so this court will have to make the same review.
Do we owe any deference?
No deference.
So what does it matter that he found him more credible?
Well, if Iran had in its briefs suggested some reason why the judge got it wrong... That might be worth something. They didn't. They simply said, our expert says no, McKesson's expert says yes.
Well, but as the Chief Judge just said to you, if we're de novo, then we just look at them ourselves.
Yes, exactly. Right? And make a determination.
So what's credibility got to do with it? I don't understand that.
I'm sorry, you don't understand?
What credibility? You said the district court found one more credible than the other, but then you, in your answer to the Chief Judge, you said we're de novo.
And on this de novo review, you'll make your own independent determination as to whether one expert or the other
is... Suppose we can't tell. What do we do?
If you cannot tell that there is a prohibition under Iranian law, then the Supreme Court's guidance in the West Virginia case is that this court has the discretion to apply compound interest to afford a full remedy.
I think we've gotten as far as we're going to get. Right. We've talked you well past your time. I'm not going to take your minute back, but you'll get only 1 minute to rebut amicus if you need something to rebut.
Thank you.
From the amicus United States.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Thomas Byron from the Department of Justice here on behalf of the United States of America. As the Court knows, we've addressed three issues in our amicus brief in this Court. I'd like, before turning to the customary international law question, to address first the question addressed by Iran's counsel at argument today, which concerns the effect of the treaty and the argument Iran has made that the treaty precludes litigation in U.S. courts against the government of Iran for claims of expropriation. That argument proceeds not from the text of the treaty, as counsel conceded this morning, but instead from the negotiating history, he says. But the negotiating history evinces no intent concerning the rights of Americans to bring lawsuits in American court against the government of Iran. Instead, what he points to is negotiating history concerning whether the ICJ would have the authority to interpret differences of opinion between the governments of Iran on the one hand and the United States on the other. Those intergovernmental disputes are quite different than the kinds of claims contemplated by the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And that brings me to the key point, which is that even if Iran were correct concerning the effect of the treaty when it was adopted and ratified in 1957, that view would be superseded by subsequent federal law, which was the enactment of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act by Congress in 1976, nearly 20 years later.
Are you suggesting that it's possible that they're right about what was intended when the treaty was signed?
No, Judge Tatel, I'm not, by any means. In fact, I think it's quite clear they've asked the wrong question about the negotiating history and the effect of the treaty. The argument they've made proceeds from the assumption that if there was no history and no understanding in the minds of the treaty negotiators that such claims as this could be brought in U.S. court, therefore such claims would forever be precluded. That, it seems to me, is not the right inquiry. Instead, the court should ask, did the negotiators on behalf of the government of the United States in undertaking to adopt this treaty with Iran mean to preclude litigation by U.S. citizens if such litigation were otherwise permissible, even if they didn't know about it?
Right.
And that question they have not answered.
So
and
how typical is this treaty?
As we explained in our brief in the 2008 case, this is an example of the friendship, commerce, and navigation treaties that were extant and widespread from the 1800s through the first half of this century.
So is there somewhere in the record of this case that tells us how many countries the United States has treaties like this with?
We've cited two articles by Mr. Walker, who was
We have a treaty like this with UK, with France?
We did have a treaty like this with France. It wasn't identical in terms, but it addressed many of the same provisions. It did not include, I should point out, the treaty with France, as far as I recall, and it's been some time since I looked at the other treaties, did not address the prompt, adequate, and effective compensation requirement in the same terms, Your Honor. There were, however, treaties
does the government have a view about that issue? I mean, if the government's position is, I take it, that this treaty only provides a remedy. This treaty is all about a remedy in the foreign court. Right?
No, Judge Tatel, I don't think that's right. What we addressed and what this court decided in the last appeal in 2008 was whether, as a matter of United States law, the Treaty of Amity creates a cause of action in United States law cognizable by federal courts.
And the answer to that?
Is no.
Right.
But the answer that this court also acknowledged and that really caused the struggle in that case is, what does it mean that a treaty is self-executing? And it's acknowledged that this provision of the Treaty of Amity is self-executing. And it does seem clear that the doctrine of self-executing treaties, which is what that litigation was all about, tells us that the self-executing treaty under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution is the law of the United States.
I see. So
there's no doubt about that.
I was wrong in my questions to counsel about the effect of the treaty on the interest issue, right?
Well,
you say it will.
This is difficult, Judge Tatel. I don't think it's clearly established one way or the other. But what I do think I wanted to emphasize
is, I thought you just said that provision of the treaty was the supreme law of the land.
I think it is under the Supremacy Clause.
Okay, so then would it apply in, let's assume that Iran is wrong in its arguments here, and that McKesson does have a cause of action in the U.S. courts under Iranian law.
Well, Judge,
would that treaty apply to that?
It's not clear, Judge Tatel. And the reason it's not clear is that then becomes a difficult choice of law issue, I think, possibly.
Uh-huh.
And the problem becomes, if McKesson relies on a cause of action created under Iranian law, even if that cause of action under Iranian law itself derives from the same treaty, it's not the same as the treaty that has effect in the United States law under the Constitution's Supremacy Clause. And the choice of law problem becomes, if there really is a difference between the way Iran views the treaty under its cause of action adopted in its law, which is fine, of course, that's a different question than this court decided in 2008, does that apply here if McKesson is relying on Iranian law, or does federal law, the treaty, through the operation of the Supremacy Clause, itself supersede somehow? That's a question the parties have not litigated. I raise it only because I think it's difficult, and your questions, it seemed to me, went to that problem.
What effect does that have on the result in the case?
I don't know that it has any effect, Chief Judge Sentell, if this court were to conclude, as McKesson has urged, that an Iranian law cause of action is sufficient to support the judgment below. Of course, we've taken no position on that question and instead addressed some different questions. The only reason I wanted to address Judge Tatel's concern is because I thought the question hadn't been precisely characterized in the earlier exchange.
Right, right.
And I think it is hard, Judge Tatel.
All right.
I do want to acknowledge that as
I agree with you that it's hard.
That much we might get agreement from the bench, I don't know about the parties.
I do want to turn to the question about whether the commercial activity exception of the FSIA can be construed like the alien tort statute in SOSA as authorizing the court to create a new federal common law cause of action founded in customary international law. And that, it seems to me, is the proper way to frame the inquiry. That's what SOSA teaches. Now, SOSA...
Well, that's, I suppose, a black letter of SOSA teaching, but SOSA teaches that the possibility exists of deriving further causes of action by a common law process in international law, but speaks specifically to the language law of nations, which is not necessarily coextensive with all international law, and even then cautions that courts are to be modest and circumspect in deriving any such cause of action, and doesn't find any.
I think that's right. It seems to me the lesson of SOSA is that even in the extraordinary case, ATS is an unusual federal statute, an unusual grant of jurisdiction, and that's what the court struggled with there. McKesson has argued, if I may continue.
I think the bottom line is I'm not ready to say this. SOSA says that ATS causes the creation of any cause of action. All it says is that ATS creates a jurisdiction within which it may be possible for the court to litigate or hear the litigation of a cause of action derived under customary international law.
If I may, Chief Judge Sentell, I think it goes a little further than that, too.
I don't think it does.
Well, let me articulate why I think it does.
Okay.
The court looked at the history and context of the ATS and concluded that because common law, as it was understood in 1789, had a very different character than we understand today. And at that time, there were at least the Blackstone III examples of the kinds of
and to this date, the Blackstone III examples are still all the Supreme Court has recognized as litigable under the ATS.
That's right. But the other thing to take away from this is that the Supreme Court in that case looked to legislative intent to determine whether there was some reason to believe Congress wanted the federal courts to take the unusual step of creating new federal common law causes of action based on customary international law. And that, after Erie, is the right inquiry. And I want to point out that
it found nothing in the way of legislative history for that statute.
Well, actually,
described it as a Lohengrin that no one knew where it came from.
Well, but the relevant
expressly
history
described it as such.
That's true, but the relevant history the court looked to wasn't what, in fact, demonstrated that at least those Blackstone III examples were contemplated by Congress at the time. So I'm not sure it's quite as clear that there's no legislative history. I would say here, though, that what Erie teaches us is that there is no general federal common law of commercial relations or of tort, as in Erie itself. But the court did go further to address commercial relations, and that the relevant inquiry here is whether Congress intended in the commercial activity exception for the federal courts to create a specialized federal common law governing the commercial relations of foreign sovereigns. And I think there's every reason to be extraordinarily skeptical of that proposition.
Right.
McKesson actually relies not on the commercial activity exception at all, but instead on A3, 1605A3, which is the expropriation exception. We would urge the court, if there's any question about what is the effect of A3, to reserve that for a case in which that question is properly presented. This case is not one in which jurisdiction...
You don't want us to decide? Suppose we agreed with you.
About what, Judge Tittle?
About the expropriation clause.
Well, we haven't taken a position on whether the expropriation exception to the FSIA itself, like the ATS, contemplates the creation of new federal common law causes of action. We think that question should be reserved for a case in which it's properly presented. So if you agree with us about that point, the court would instead then focus solely on the commercial activity exception and not inquire into whether in a different case a cause of action could be found or created by a court under federal common law based on customary international law for expropriation in a case in which jurisdiction is founded on the expropriation exception, because this is not such a case. If the court has any questions concerning our position on customary international law or on the active state doctrine, we'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, we appreciate the opportunity to make our views known before the court. Thank you.
Well, we thank the United States for its appearance as amicus. I suppose everybody found something to rebut in that. You've got 1 minute from the appellee first, and then we'll go to the appellate.
Thank you. I think we agree that the right inquiry here is whether Congress has expressed the intention that our federal courts adjudicate claims for expropriation in violation of international law. And they have, in two statutes. First, the Second Hickenlooper Amendment in 1964, and then in the FSIA in 1976. In both statutes, Congress explicitly, in statutory language, referred to our courts adjudicating claims for a taking of property in violation of international law. So as the Sosa court indicated, the court's task is to look for some indication, some understanding by Congress that our courts will apply this type or this specific international law, and we have it in two statutes. So it's not for this court out of whole cloth to create a new cause of action. Congress has said, we want you to decide these claims. We don't want you to apply the active state doctrine unless the United States comes forward and certifies that it's in the foreign policy interests of the U.S., and it hasn't done that here. And in the FSIA, they expressly talked about the cause of action. We all agree the FSIA is only jurisdictional. It doesn't create a cause of action. So where does it come from? Congress understood that it already existed. It legislated with the understanding that in the Second Hickenlooper Amendment...
You have finished.
Thank
you. Minute and 26 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellant. We'll give him back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to try to make 3 points really quickly. First, on the interest point, we cited Article 713 of Iranian law in our brief. It's in the appendix to our opening brief. It says damages which are arisen out of damages are not recoverable. McKesson did not respond to that argument in its brief. Interest isn't available. Secondly, I'm going to take a leap here and say that if McKesson has a cause of action, it's under Iranian law. And if that's true, then we're now interpreting the Treaty of Amity under Iranian law. And Iran does not think that it permits suit in this country. Iran thinks it permits suit in Iran.
Well, suppose you're wrong about that.
Well,
suppose we don't agree. Suppose
the court will have to take a de novo look at that.
Well, what I'm asking you, if we don't agree with that, then they do have a FSIA case in the courts here, don't they? Under Iranian law.
Right. I think that if they have a case, it's here under Iranian law.
Right.
And I think the court, we've talked about lenses, needs to look at this under the lens of Iranian law, including the treaty, how Iran interprets the treaty. Mm-hmm. And more generally, you're looking at this de novo. I'd just like to say that this is going to be a difficult task for the court. Because, as I said, the district court really didn't look at it that way. And I wanted to point out JA 178, where the district court says that it reaffirms Judge Flannery's award of damages under the treaty. And this is typical of the award. He cites prior decisions in this case under American law six times. There is no citation to Iranian law. Mm-hmm. If this court embarks on a de novo review of this case, you really have to start de novo, Your Honors. Perhaps you should direct McKesson to go seek an award in Iran and put this case on hold.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, you have very promptly finished, barely over your 2 minutes, for which the court thanks you.
Thank you.
A rare occurrence, and we appreciate it. Case is submitted. Call the next case.